Lead us on.
Education is not job training. Education is not schooling. Education is knowledge tied to wisdom. Education is knowing what things are for, not just knowing how they work. The truly educated person understands the proper use of things like bodies and brains and governments and art and sport, not just how to eat or how to carry out difficult mathematical computations or how to win an election or how to hit a curveball. The difference between those two things is the difference between wisdom on the one hand and information on the other hand. It's the difference between knowledge and data. It's the difference between knowing and knowing about. Those who acquire wisdom and knowledge are the educated folks. Those who gain only data or information are just technicians. Technicians are replaceable by the next generation of machines. If you want to be replaceable, just be a mental technician. But notice this. No machine can ever replace Socrates or people like him. Socrates and his kind can do what no machine ever can. Love, worship, rejoice, grieve, repent, in short, understand. Authentic understanding and the suitable responses that authentic understanding makes possible are not the result of job training or technical expertise. When the Delphic Oracle was asked, "Who's the wisest of men?" the oracle was reported to have said, "Socrates of Athens is the wisest of men." And when Socrates heard it, he was surprised to hear it. "Who, me?" he wondered. "I don't know anything." But then as he thought about it, he realized, "Oh yeah, the oracle's right. I am wiser than those other guys because I know I'm ignorant and they don't know they are." As long as they were ignorant of their ignorance, they could never fix it. Well, those true and humbling lessons aren't the sort of things we can learn about ourselves from schools that train us just to learn how to program a VCR. That's because a teacher can take you no further than the teacher himself or herself has already gone. You can't give your students what you don't have. And the technicians of our day and the self-esteem peddlers of our day cannot and do not teach us the truth about ourselves. Instead, they teach their students that to feel good is at least as important as to do good. And it isn't. They teach students that to get a job and make money, that's the main purpose of education. It's not. Now, because views like that are twisted and foolish, and because twisted and foolish always comes at a really high price, Socrates used to say that it's the teacher's proper job to reveal to the student's own ignorance, in the hope that that kind of self-knowledge would be deflating, and this deflating and unpleasant experience would drive them to want to get out of it and to fix it and to learn something. Socrates knew that real self-knowledge feels an awful lot like mental root canal. But that fact did not persuade him that his students should be protected from it. He knew that the truth often hurts because the truth about us is often unflattering. Well, unflattering or not, real self-knowledge is absolutely indispensable to education. Without real self-knowledge, you can never say that you are truly learned. Socrates understood that you come into this world in complete, total, and seamless ignorance, and that precious few people ever get out of it. He understood that given our flawed condition, any kind of undeserved and unearned praise is the fountain of apathy and the death of learning. If you think the way to get students to learn is feel-goodism, you're completely backwards. Feel-goodism won't lead to education. Feel-goodism is to the mental life of the uneducated what abortion is to the unborn. It's going to kill somebody. Look, feel-goodism is a way of, it's like the pill, it's a way of preventing conception. In Christian terms, not Socrates' terms, in Christian terms, we are a fallen and sinful race of persons. We are the reason that the whole world's gone haywire. We're the crown of creation and we're the scum of the earth at the same time. And that makes us hard to understand. We are mysteries even to ourselves. That's why the Bible says that our humanity is hid with Christ in God. And you won't know who you are really until Christ comes back again with your humanity in tow, so to speak. Well, these true and humbling lessons that no mere technician can teach us are fundamentally important to getting an education. By the way, I said getting an education. An education is something you get, it's not something you're given. No one can give you one. You have to get it. And if you don't get one, it's your fault. You can go to a really good school and not get an education. You can go to a really bad school and get one, because an education is an achievement, not a gift. If you don't have one, you know who to blame. But blame isn't part of modern education. The charlatans of self-esteem in our public schools deceive us about ourselves. We require repentance and hard work. We don't require heavy doses of feel-goodism. And we don't require just mountains of data and information. We require knowledge in the service of wisdom. We require Martin Luther's internal torments of guilt before a holy God. We don't require Norman Vincent Peale's positive thinking. That's not what will cure what ails us. Think of it this way. The job well done precedes satisfaction. It doesn't follow them. Modern education has the cart before the horse. They think that if Johnny feels good, Johnny will do good work. They don't understand that until Johnny does good work, he won't feel good about himself. As in so many other things, the modern technicians of public schooling and of the baseless feel-goodism that's there, they've set the cart before the horse. They bow in abject servitude to what they call the affective domain, how Johnny feels about himself. I don't care how Johnny feels. I care how Johnny thinks. I care if Johnny thinks. And if Johnny thinks, he'll know what he should feel about himself. You ought to banish the affective domain from the classroom forever. Education isn't about making you feel good or how you feel. Education is about the cognitive domain. You must know something or you're not educated. Look, if you just want to train kids, well, then teach them to read, write, and to compute. Teach them history and science, but don't mistake acquiring those skills for education. Those things are how you get an education. They're not an education. If you want to educate kids rather than just to train them, then remember that an educated person can give careful and insightful answers to the fundamental questions of life, the diagnostic questions of life. And here they are. These are the diagnostic questions of life. What's a good life, and what good is life? What's a good death, and what good is death? What's a good love, and what good is love? And what's a human being? If you haven't learned to ask and to answer those questions, well, you are not an educated person. But our children have never learned to ask such questions, much less figured out how to answer them with wisdom and insight. That's because the teachers can't give the students what the teachers don't have, and the teachers don't know how to ask and answer these questions themselves. The man who hired me at Hillsdale, who was the vice president for academic affairs back then, used to always ask candidates for a job this question: what's a human being? Because he figured if you didn't know what a human being was, you don't deserve a job here. Because you've been one all your life, and you still don't know what they are? You're going to be teaching other ones. You don't know what human beings are? If you know what a human being is, well, then I guess you should keep looking someplace else for a job. But our students don't ask those questions. If they had read Aristotle, they'd know that if you want to succeed, you have to ask the right preliminary questions. If you don't ask the right question the right way, you can't succeed. But these aren't the questions our students ask. These are the questions our students ask. Will this be on the test? Will this help me get a job? Will this make me feel good? It would kill Socrates a second time to hear it. Which means reason is under siege in our schools. There's almost no idea so preposterous that some school board somewhere won't pay you a handsome fee to promote it, and some local newspaper won't write it up as a breakthrough. Now, I'm going to give you an actual historical illustration from my hometown. A newspaper reporter named Marilyn Fryer attended a local public school get-together, what they called an innovation in service. And the public schools invited William Glasser to teach at this in service. So everything I'm going to say comes right from the newspaper article that Fryer wrote about Glasser at the in service and what the teachers did and did not do while they were there. Glasser gave a keynote address to what was called the innovation in service. Now, in service what? We don't know. Because despite every grammatical indication to the contrary, in service is apparently a thing and not a description of a thing. Now, language of that sort strikes me as the grammar-free zone called public schools. And so I'm thinking, somebody has been learning how to speak educationese. And I hold the teachers responsible for that because they're the ones who consented to put on this seminar and invite this man to speak, to pay him to speak, and to sit and listen for the whole day to him to speak. Glasser's intention at this in-service, if you can trust the newspaper story, and you can't. His intention was to insist upon this quotation: quality must be the focus of all American schools. Quality must be the focus of all American schools. Now, if you're like me, you naturally expect that the focus of all American schools ought to be education. Now, maybe that's what Glasser meant to say, but couldn't find the words to say. I don't know. Or if he could find the words to say them, Fryer the reporter couldn't. When a news story tells me that something other than education, something like quality, ought to be a school's central concern, this piques my interest. I want to keep reading because I think there must be a joke coming. I want to hear what a man who actually agrees to speak at something called an in-service says about the quality that allegedly displaces education as our school's main concern. I want to read on. It was what I expected. He goes on to say, no one can define quality. Quality must be the focus of all American schools. No one can define quality. At least, that's what Fryer wrote that he said in her newspaper article. Now, shockingly, Fryer does not report that any of the in-servicers interrupted Glasser to say that the impossible had actually been done. Quality is, in fact, definable. The editors and compilers of the Oxford English Dictionary have done it in remarkable detail. The Oxford English Dictionary identifies 30 definitions for the word quality, which it arranges under four headings and 13 subheadings, and which it supplements with 90 illustrations brought from texts written over the last 400 years. See, apparently, quality can be defined in remarkable detail. We know how that word is used. But not one teacher, not one in-servicer pointed out that obvious fact to Glasser. What a scoop Fryer missed for her newspaper. Local teachers cannot use English dictionaries. If Glasser had said that quality is a word that neither in-servicers nor those whom they pay to speak to them can define, I would say, okay, that's true. But no. Glasser apparently delivered an entire day-long seminar on something that no one in the room could identify or define. According to Fryer, not one in-servicer walked out muttering as they left that they had better things to do than to listen to a guy talk about quality who didn't even know what the word meant. Glasser then went on and said, quality is always useful in some way. Which can only mean that quality is very much like hand grenades, bubble gums, and suppositories, which are useful in some way. Now, I suppose this is a good time to tell you that Glasser's most important book is called Reality Therapy. Quality, Glasser then went on to say, quality can be learning a skill, or discovering something to help society, or creating a work deemed as artistic or intellectual by others. But think about that. Learning a skill is not quality. Learning a skill is training. by this mealy-mouthedness nonsense, did Glasser mean but not actually say that learning a skill was quality training? But if quality training is learning a skill, how does quality training differ from mere training, which is also learning a skill? If the difference between the two is a difference in competence, and not competency, as educationists always say, well, then what degree of competence distinguishes training from quality training, or is that undefinable too? Furthermore, if you find some way to rid the world of menaces like Hitler and Stalin, or their contemporary counterparts, that helps society, and it's useful in some way, but I wouldn't call it quality or education. And just because others deem your efforts as intellectual or artistic, that signifies precisely nothing. Remember the Flat Earth Society? They still exist, and they insist that calling the Earth flat is intellectually respectable. And some people say that a plastic Jesus submerged in a tub of urine is art. They're wrong. Just because something's been called or deemed intellectual and artistic doesn't mean it's any good. Others, after all, include people like in-servicers. And would you trust them? Now, by this point, apparently in the seminar, Glasser's on a roll. Having determined that quality was undefinable, but yet still useful and helpful to society, and deemed intellectual and artistic by others, he then told the in-servicers, or are they in-servicees? I mean, it all depends, I guess, if they're being in-serviced or are doing the in-servicing. He told them what quality is not. Quotation. It is not teaching students things that are not necessary to them, such as when Columbus discovered America. See, you thought I was exaggerating when I mentioned the flat earthers, didn't you? I don't. Exactly how to determine what is or is not necessary for students to learn, and precisely why the fundamental facts of American history and world geography fall into that particular category, Glasser did not tell us. And Fryer, the reporter, did not ask. I don't know why. Neither did the in-servicers ask. I think those omissions are staggering. So Glasser went back to his original approach. He added even more definitions to the already burgeoning litany of characteristics ascribable to this undefinable notion of quality. Quality, he said, always feels good. I remind you that his book is called Reality Therapy. Glasser then observed that a quality school can always be improved. Well, think about it. Think about those last two statements. I'll read them to you again. Quality always feels good. And a quality school can always be improved. Now, if you put those two things together, and you should, you will notice that correcting a student's errors, which rarely ever feels good, must not be part of a quality education. Because quality always feels good. Now, you remember when I talked about Columbus and the flat earth guys, I said I wasn't exaggerating? Now, I'm still not exaggerating. In fact, according to Glasser, correcting student errors is not part of a quality school. Instead, All, this is a quotation. All students are asked to check their own work. Now, why teachers are spared this burden and foist it off onto the students and still expect to get paid with taxpayer dollars, I do not know. And what would you do if when this, you ask the students to check their work, they say no? Maybe Glasser expects the number of errors needing correction to be exceedingly few, because he also says in a quality school, all tests are open book. See, in quality schools, teachers are spared not only the burden of correcting student errors, they're also spared the burden of dealing with students who need individualized instruction. Why? Because Glasser says, in quality schools, a core of good students will be trained to serve as tutors for any student who needs one-on-one. One-on-one what? Is left unspecified. Well, when you think about the staggering possibilities, maybe that was better. And when you think about this, I'll read the sentence again. In a quality school, a core of good students, core, C-O-R-P-S, when a core of good students, I say that in case Obama was here, because... a core of good students will be trained to serve as tutors for any student who needs one-on-one. Well, please notice that the word core is a plural entity. And that this core of students will be called upon to teach any student who needs one-on-one. Apparently, one is an undefinable concept, too. Now, it could be that Glasser never actually said all those things that Fryer has him say about quality schools. Because after all, Fryer the reporter has this sentence in her story. Other characteristics of a quality school is that it can always be improved. Well, I don't know to whom this grammatical blunder belongs. To Glasser? To those who gave Glasser a doctorate? To the in-servicers? To Fryer? To her proofreaders? To her editor? I just know this, that somebody somewhere is the product of a quality school. A school where students didn't have to learn things that were not necessary to them. Things like correct English. Now, if the picture isn't clear to you yet, and if you haven't figured out why people like Glasser get paid great mountains of money to address public school in-servicers, let me explain it to you. This all happens, number one, because in-servicers know that if they can ever come up with a quality school, they won't have to teach boring subjects like American history and world geography. Two, it happens because they can ask the students to do the one-on-one. And three, they won't have to correct any papers. Any student who needs correction can be taught by the student tutor corps. And in the end, everyone feels good. See, in-servicers might be mistaken, but they're not stupid. They know what they're going for. Make up your own mind about newspaper reporters. So, what do you do? If this is the state of things in America, how can you escape back to reason? I would say, let's do our best to fry the fools in their own juices and follow Richard Mitchell's example. Let's hang them with their own rope. So I'm going to take words from the horse's mouth. This is a, well, here's the quotation, then I'll tell you where it came from. Quote, schools will become clinics whose purpose is to provide individualized psychosocial treatment for the student. Teachers must become psychosocial therapists. Children are to become the objects of experimentation. Now, that sounds like it came from Joseph Mengele, the Nazi witch doctor, doesn't it? No. It comes from the former president of the National Education Association, the largest labor union in the nation, the union to which most public school teachers must belong if they want to earn a living. Now, on the assumption that America's teachers actually believe in the principles of the organizations they join, that quotation shows you that you have been fooling yourself, and so have I. We thought we were watching little boys and girls go off to school every morning in search of an education. What we really were seeing were hapless little guinea pigs on the way to the laboratory. Unsuspecting objects, their word, objects of psychological experimentation, their word, and treatment, their word. The NEA said that, not I. And this experimentation and this treatment are administered by people who aren't even psychologists. Their methods are intended to produce behavioral outcomes which aren't the same as real learning. Now, I hope that when I tell you that this horrifying policy has been in place for more than 40 years, and that the NEA has never, ever renounced it, and that as a result, you yourself might likely be one of its victims, I hope you will feel violated and decide to put an end to this nonsense. The simple and plain truth is that therapy is not education. And education is not therapy. And teaching is not a treatment. And lesson plans are not experimentation. And children are not objects. But all that stuff seems lost on the schools, because too many schools and their teachers would rather treat our children than to teach them. How do you know? You have their own words on it. Our schools don't need amateur psychologists by the tens of thousands. Our schools need teachers who teach. The school is supposed to be a forum for learning, not a psychiatric clinic where psychologist wannabes pretend to be shrinks and subject other people's kids to incompetent therapy without parental knowledge or consent. I mean, the fact that America's school teachers are staggeringly and dangerously inept psychologists seems not to slow them down at all. In fact, if you want to be scared, listen to this quotation. Listen to what one NEA counselor tells his teacher as psychologist wannabes. He says, "Don't sell yourself short because I'm not a therapist," or "I've only had 3 psych courses," or "I might destroy the child's psychological balance." Take a chance. Follow your instincts. Well, I have an instinct right about now, and he wouldn't like it. You see, there's an arrogance there that makes the blood run cold. When you hear them talk, you think, how do they ever get to where they are? Because that is where they are. It's worse than that. I mean, I'm not giving you all the bad stuff up front. The NEA has a lot more tricks up its collective sleeves than just subverting traditional education by Freud frauds. As I would, I suspect, I hope, that you think the ultimate goal of any educational organization ought to be education. Well, think so no longer. According to one former NEA president, this is a quotation, "The ultimate goal of the NEA is to tap the legal, political, and economic powers of the U.S. Congress. We want leaders and staff with sufficient clout that they can roam the halls of Congress and collect votes to reorder the priorities of the United States. I'll read it again. The ultimate goal of the NEA is to tap the legal, political, and economic powers of the U.S. Congress. We want leaders and staff with sufficient clout that they can roam the halls of Congress and collect votes to reorder the priorities of the United States. Now, just so you don't think that his views are unusual inside the NEA, listen to another former NEA president who says, "There is no alternative to political action. Instruction and professional development have been put on the back burner to us compared to political action." So you get it? Not only do these guys replace teaching with therapy and with treatment and with experimentation, they replace teaching with politics and nothing. Not even the education of the children or the development of the teachers gets in the way. You have their word on it. They said so. I'm just quoting. See, whether they want it or not, most local school teachers across the country have to pay hundreds of dollars or more in extortion money every year, normally called dues, in order to be a part of this wonderful anti-education union conspiracy called the NEA. A conspiracy designed, they say, to reorder the priorities of the United States. And if the teachers don't pay, the teachers don't work. That's not education. That's a racket. It's a shakedown. These policies have been the NEA's agenda for many, many years. They are not the inconsequential ideas of some Johnny-come-lately in American education. These notions have been on the books. These words and ideas have been in the notions of those in charge for about 40 years. Now, the NEA is a labor union. Think of it this way. Putting education in the hands of a labor union makes about as much sense as putting the longshoremen in charge of the Navy. What would happen? So let me make it perfectly plain, if it isn't yet. If you want better instruction in your local school system, then you're going to have to persuade the school board to liberate any teacher from the greedy clutches of the local teachers' union. Anyone that wants to leave it should be free to leave it. We do, you recall, have a constitutional right to association. We can choose to or not to associate with others. You must persuade the school board to hire teachers and principals and a superintendent who are smart enough to distinguish education from therapy and from politics. And if your school board has to fight this thing all the way to the Supreme Court, well, then you make them fight. You make your school board fire any principal or superintendent who fails to support true academic freedom or who lacks the courage and the insight to stand up to the NEA and its relentless psychobabble and its leftist institutional totalitarianism. If the members of your school board will not do that, you must vote those bums out of office. If you do that, the word gets out. Your school system becomes flooded with applications from the finest teachers around the country and the finest administrators around the country, people who know what schools are for, people who prefer teaching to psychologizing, who prefer academic administration to being the NEA's on-site thugs and the enforcers of its union extortions. Who works in the schools is up to you, because who's on the school board's up to you. And you have to be able to figure out how to do this at least on a small scale, like locally. If you can't manage to be good at this in your own hometown, you're not going to be good at it on a larger scale. Now, you know what your situation is in your local hometown. You know who's who, and your job is to figure out how to. If this is a chess game, and think about it, how many thousands of hours do you suppose Boris Spassky had to spend learning chess? Tens of thousands, right? And that's why he was so hard to beat. You have to put in your 10,000 hours figuring out how to move the pieces about on the chessboard of public policy in your own local school system. It's going to take a while. It won't be easy. But if you don't do it, who's going to? You can't pass the buck off onto somebody else because they want to pass it off onto you. And then it never gets done. So think it through with great care and precision. Become a virtuoso of local politics and get this done. And if you get it done, you know, it's like the movie, if you build it, they will come. If you change your schools, they'll come. The good teachers and administrators will flock to places like this where they realize, my goodness, that town really actually values education. They want me. I'm going there. Any questions or comments?
With an interesting question here that maybe we can address, and that certainly words do have meaning, but how about body language, intonation, our inflection, how we use our voice, how we use our body and our eye contact? That certainly adds to the meaning also, doesn't it?
Yes, it can. Now, just like some people are rhetorically inept, they'll choose the wrong word to do the wrong a job it's not suited for doing. Some people are, I'm one of them, visually inept. Like, I have bad eyes, and so I can't look at individual people very well. Some people, and I'm not so good at inflection. I have a verbal habit where my voice tends to go down at the end of sentences. And so, yes, I agree with you. Those things are important when it comes to most effective communication. And so you pick the right words and you deliver them in the most effective way. That's a lot to think about all at once. But then again, who said it was going to be easy to be like Jesus? So you do it.
I really have two questions. One is, are you aware of Common Core, which is it's a mandate of a national curriculum that's happened nationwide. So 45 states have adopted it, but they did it through the state boards of education. So anyway, we're just starting to fight this, but that's taking complete control away from school districts. But the other thing is that they think, I've done a lot of study on this, they think it's based basically on Socratic thought and some of the things you're talking about. So my question is this, you talked about the difference between knowledge and education. And what they seem to think is that they can take away 70% of the literature in our English classes in high school. So Shakespeare, Homer, all of that, and have the children do higher level thinking skills. So I'm wondering if you don't think that we need a certain amount of education in order to actually do this, to get knowledge and to have the Socratic thought. I mean, if you don't know anything, my question is, how are you doing any higher level thinking? I was just wondering about your response to that.
Yeah, well, education is to some degree an apprenticeship, which means you have to spend time with the master in order to learn the skills. You can't be much of a blacksmith if you've never worked next to a blacksmith. You can't read a book on it. It won't happen that way. And you can't learn how to hit a major league curveball by reading a book. You're going to have to actually stand there and have the coach explain every single detail of your swing and micromanage all the smallest dimensions of it. Now, if you're going to say to students, you don't need to spend time with Shakespeare or Thomas Aquinas or Dante, what they're saying is you don't have to spend time with the masters in order to get an education. Well, if you don't spend time with the masters, learning your education and getting this apprenticeship in hand, where would these high and lofty thoughts come from? Because the human brain isn't a jungle that you have to cut down because it just keeps growing all kinds of lush green things. It's more like a desert that has to be watered. And Shakespeare and Dante and Spencer, that's the water. And if you don't you know what it's like not to have much water. So what would happen if that's what was going on inside people's brains in public schools? All of a sudden, the desert spreads. We're here to turn the desert into a garden, not turn the garden into a desert. It's going to take a lot of water. And it's going to take time with Shakespeare. I mean, one modern critic said that Shakespeare invented the human. That is, his plays are so remarkably like real life, you learn how to be a human better by watching the plays. You're going to leave Shakespeare out of this. You're in effect going to be leaving out a lot of what it means to be a human out of this. And education is how to help students grow up to be authentic human beings. This is what Lewis is getting at in his little book called The Abolition of Man. If you're going to teach people, there are certain questions you have to ask and answer before you begin to teach. And one of the things you must ask and answer is, what sort of a thing is the universe? And what sort of a thing is a human being? Because if you don't have good answers to those questions, you won't know what and how to teach. And you won't know how to answer those questions well unless you spend time with, say, St. Augustine or Jeremiah or Isaiah or whomever else. It's not like the little kiddies are going to come up with all this stuff on their own. Let's just back off and let's see what they come up with. Well, they're going to come up with the sort of things little kiddies come up with. And it's frequently nonsensical. Or it might be well-intentioned. You know, they might be nice little kiddies. But it's not going to be the sort of stuff you can build a life on.
When we talk about the younger generation and where they're getting their information, that makes me think about the iPod and the iPad. So the antidote to the hours, probably 1,000 hours by the time they're in high school.
Or more than that.
Yeah. That they have been exposed to this kind of information and learning. I'm going to get back to that in a minute. But you mentioned Socrates, and I wondered, what is the Christian counterpart or the godly, even though Socrates, of course, was pre-incarnation, but even then he wasn't what we might call biblical. He wasn't believing the Torah or the revelation we had at that point of that God had given us. So in this time, that what would be the Christian counterpart to Socrates who thought like he did? Could we call a Johann Kepler or a Blaise Pascal, if I've said his name right, or a Louis Pasteur, an Isaac Newton? Who are these people who were strong thinkers in a biblical framework?
Well, I think that you have to go to Christ. That He's the teacher you emulate or try to. And pay attention not just to his words, but pay attention to how he teaches and who he chooses to teach. At Hillsdale, we have a small college, about 1,400 students. Now, that seems small, but look, by Jesus' standards, that's about 100 times too big. The greatest teacher in the history of the world decides, I think I'll pick about 12. And I'll spend 3 years with them day and night. And in the end, one of those 12 betrays him. One of those 12 denies him 3 times, and all the rest run away in fear. Now, if that's what happens when the best teacher in the world spends 3 years with human beings, isn't it remarkably arrogant for us to think, and I'm here, I'm speaking about us at Hillsdale, to think we can do this with 1,400 or 1,500 people all at once? And we're small. Michigan State up the road has 42,000. Well, our previous president used to say, and I agreed with him, he said, no matter what else you might call 600 students in the classroom, it isn't higher education. And so you're going to have to be more humble and aim smaller and do this little job really well rather than thinking I'll do 1,000 at a time. Nobody can do 1,000 at a time. Jesus is proof. If he can't do it, probably we can't do it. So, limit the scope a bit and select people that are teachable. You can't tell the teachable people by whether or not they have a hyphenated last name, by their ethnic background, by their gender, by their sexual preference, by any of the things that we now use to let students into college. Those aren't how you tell teachable people. You're going to have to figure something else out or realize your school's education has been radically undermined because the admissions office has been crippled by the federal government and won't let the right students in, and they won't let us hire the people who we want. You know, I've heard them at Michigan say that education's about diversity. That's just Michigan's view of, that's their word that replaces quality. See? College isn't about diversity. It's about wisdom and truth and goodness and beauty. Why don't we say to them, you guys are actually bigots. You're bigots because it's about excellence. And you think if we went for excellent people, that it wouldn't be diverse. What makes you think that? Do you really think that unless we specifically carved out a quota for black folks or for Hispanic folks, that if we went for excellence, they wouldn't show up? We're not going to run our admissions office on the basis of that bigotry. So at Hillsdale, we don't care where you come from or who you are. If you can do the job, that's what matters. Make sure that the college you're thinking about does that too. It's not about diversity. It's about insight. Look, let's say that I was the head of the English department or the modern languages at Hillsdale. No, it's something else. Let's say I'm the head of history. Now, I don't care if every person on the history faculty happens to be a female from Seoul, Korea. If they're the best person for the job, that's who gets the job. I don't care if they're diverse. I care if they're really good. And it might be, who knows? We'll have to see, that if you hire all the best persons, they all turn out to be females from Seoul, South Korea. Well, God bless them. Who cares?
I actually like your comments. You talked about 10,000 hours of resources that we could spend to work on changing the perspectives and philosophies of our public school system. What about if we took those same resources and applied them to Christian classical education and homeschooling rather than fighting an institution that is probably dying? And using those resources to provide an education that is outside of the sphere and authority of the state and under the auspices of family and Christ to change our culture. Just curious about your commentary on that.
No, I think that's a perfectly legitimate point. What you'll have to do is recall that God has his people all over the place. And perhaps he's called some of them to the public schools and some of them to private schools. Wherever God has called you, that's where you invest your 10,000 hours. And I can see good reason for doing what you just said. Let's invest our 10,000 hours of research and homework in making these private schools better. That's a highly worthwhile project. God bless you and go for it. I think it's also a worthwhile project to try and redeem what's out there in the world, because this is our Father's world. And Christ is the Lord of education, even if the educationists don't know it. And so we're going to... The postmodernists like to say, well, let's just make sure that everybody has a voice, everybody has a place at the table. No. We're not just trying to give Jesus a place at the table. He owns the table. And it's going to take a while. Since we backed... Look, early in the 20th century, evangelicals backed out of the public square. And into that void came all sorts of things. And now we're reaping the whirlwind. We have to figure out how to get those guys out of the public square and how to win it back for its rightful Lord. And we're not very good at it. All too often, in my opinion, we replace competence with piety. I'll pray for it, as opposed to I'm going to learn how to get really, really good at this. I want you to pray for it, of course. But prayer isn't a substitute for expertise. Just because you're a Christian doesn't mean you're going to win this battle by praying. By all means, you should pray. That isn't the only thing you should be doing. In addition to your hours of prayer, you should invest these hours of mastering the disciplines and the techniques and the politics and the economic. You have to master this thing. The left took about 75 years to take over the schools. You think you're going to do this in 6 weeks? No. It's going to take years. You have to have the long view, and you have to be really patient and set things up for this to happen maybe after you're gone from the scene. You have to be that patient and that much foresighted. But I agree with you. Humanly speaking, there doesn't seem to be much hope in redeeming the public schools. And it seems to be a better investment and certainly less of a major hurdle to jump if you're going after the private schools, because they seem to have not gone down that path the public schools have, and at least not so far. So yeah, I agree. Whatever your calling is from God, then you go serve there. And do the very best you possibly can. It is your moral obligation before God in a fallen world. Serve where whatever portion of His vineyard He's put you in, that's where you should serve. And go do it.
Really agree with the comment too, by the way. About a year from now or so, we're going to try and do something focused on Montana Family Foundation. And address this. And unfortunately, while I agree with your effort idea, the vast majority of the soldiers are not going to go that direction. And like Michael has said, we need to not give up on the rest of our culture.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you think homeschooling will affect the future of this country?
I think homeschooling is one of the bright lights and one of the reasons we have for hope. Because even though the homeschool movement is relatively young compared to its alternatives, it's already producing very good students. We haven't been at this very long. We haven't learned all we can learn about schooling at home. But like I said, at Hillsdale, some of our best students are our homeschoolers. Now, by the way, some of our worst students are our homeschoolers, too. Both those things are true. And so if we can figure out how to make that already useful movement better, great. Because I think that will draw more and more folks into the movement, and they will produce more and more well-educated, useful homeschool students who can go out and do whatever it is God called them to do. But yeah, I think there's lots of hope there and reason for it.
I have a question. It's a little diversion here, if we could, Michael.
Sure.
This morning you said something about your friend Greg Kokel with Stand to Reason, who's going to be here in early May. Give us a little shot about this man.
Well, Greg is he and I are the same age, so you're going to have to deal with some old geezer again. But Greg and I both come from Illinois, and we both were converted later. Greg is an intelligent, articulate Christian whose life's work is expressing and defending the Christian faith. And he decides that he's not going to live his life in a cloister. He goes out and engages the world. He has a radio program that goes across the country, so he's going to talk to anybody and everybody if he gets the chance. And what you might like to do is when you hear Greg's radio program and you hear the people that call in, just listen carefully to how he responds to the questions, because he has in his mind mapped out all the useful tactics. Sometimes he's oblique and tangential in order to move around a thing and come at it from the back. Sometimes he's direct and head on. But through these 20 years of experience of encountering objections and objectors to Christianity, he's learned well how this is done most effectively. So I would say, listen to a guy with the practice. He's put in his 10,000 hours, and you'll be glad you heard him speak, because it's wise, it's clear, it's understandable, it's enjoyable, and it's practical. So I would say, yeah, if Greg is here, make your best attempt to hear him. You won't be disappointed.
One more question, and then we'll call it quits.
This seems to be a big subject today, the Common Core thing. In the Common Core program is... And what we're going to have a school bond issue come up about technology funding, and they're going to have the computers and teaching with the iPads and things in at very young ages, and that's part of Common Core. I was just wondering if you had any opinion on that.
Well, there are times when the computer is the best you can do. If you live in a place that's isolated and distant from good schools, that's your connectivity. That's the best you can do. But I would be happy with computers in that sort of a situation. But in most school situations, I think computers get in the way of education. Because if education is your time with the master, the computer can't be the master. The computer can't have a dialogue with you and understand what your answers mean and then instantaneously sort out the weaknesses in your answers in order to ask questions that expose the weakness that your view has. This is going to require a human being with a well-functioning mind and an insightful understanding of things. No computer can be programmed that way. And so you can't really do Socratic dialogue by means of a computer, because no program can do it. No program can reach there. And so the Socrates people have nothing to worry about when, in terms of actually being really and effectively, productively replaced, can't be done, which probably means the schools will try to do it. Because free men like Socrates aren't subject to programming. And we have school systems that aren't interested in standing out, but in fitting in. And you want to make sure that you don't fit in, you stand out. And computers will always fit in because they always do what they're programmed to do. And be careful that you don't program your kids to do the same thing with the programmed computers.
In about 10 minutes, I have to sweep this gentleman back off to the airport because Michigan is calling. So you'll have a few minutes to engage him. But before that, will you tell him thanks?